Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This is a special podcast sponsored by the Alexander Soros Foundation, a series of podcasts by Rabbi Daniel Landes. This episode by Rabbi Landes is Yom HaTzma'ut and the Nakba. Is a Jewish theology of a Palestinian state possible? There is a study sheet for this podcast that I'll be sending as the next episode, so please look for that. Rabbi Daniel Landes is the director of the Pardes Institute in Jerusalem. And now, Rabbi Daniel Landes.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you to the Alexander Soros Foundation. Sponsoring this series has allowed me to spend some time thinking about how to view our tradition and its contemporary situation, relevance, and especially those challenges that we have not fully confronted. Last time with Passover confronted the change in the process, the liberation of the self. Now I'm actually going to speak about Yom HaTzma'ut, the liberation of the Jewish people, but also in the context, Yom HaTzma'ut and the Nakba, the disaster, how the Palestinians, most of them, can never speak about a group completely, but the political arm of the Palestinian movement, how they view this disaster that took place when the Jews declared a state. My real question is a Jewish theology of a Palestinian state possible? Until recently, I would say absolutely, of course it's impossible. No way could it be possible. But I started to think that, indeed, this is one of the difficulties that we have in making peace. The overall difficulty, of course, is the problem of violence. And I, myself, have great difficulty with the violence emanating from the Arab-Palestinian population. But when you consider what will be in the future, you always have to think ahead. You have to imagine. And I think one of our great lacks from the Jewish community is to see how we could view a Palestinian state. Make my position clearer that a wide range of governmental leaders, Jewish leaders, have said this is actually our goal. You know, two different states, each state for its own people, and that a Palestinian state will take place. As unthinkable as it was earlier, it could very well be headed down that line. If that's the case, we have to think about how we view it. I say the Nakba partially is what I'm not being able to accomplish. I'm not a spokesperson for the Palestinian people. They certainly don't desire that, nor do I. And their narrative is not my narrative. But this Palestinian state does take place. If we find a modus operandi to have peace, how can we understand it ourselves? How can we view it? I'll start with the kind of the difficulty by looking at founding documents of the two countries, the first founding document. And here you're able to access the source sheets, and here the source sheets are very important for this class, for this lecture. And the first source sheet is that of the Declaration of Establishment of the State of Israel, just a part of it. And this is the official translation when it emerged. English, as you know, is one of the languages of the State of Israel, although the Declaration of Independence was written in Hebrew. And here, as you look at number A on the first page, you see, when it talks about Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, the term State of Israel is not fully here yet. Talk about Palestine. Talk about the glorious history, birthplace of Jewish people, spiritual, religious, political identity was shaped here. Their first statehood, referring to the First and Second Commonwealth, cultural values, and the echoes of David Ben-Gurion, but we all could agree, gave the world the eternal book of all books, the Tanakh. So that's the past, and almost the distant past. And then the more recent pass, as it were, the exile from the land that the people came kept faith with the land of Israel. They kept faith with it in their prayers, in their hopes, their aspirations, many visiting, and there was always a permanent settle in Israel. And the third paragraph is the word, the present strove in every successive generation to reestablish themselves. And the Declaration of Independence, talking about the earlier part of the 20th century, pioneers, Ma'apilim, immigrants coming to, in defiance of restrictive legislation, defenders. And it talks about the great, once again, the great accomplishments, the deserts bloom, revival of a language and a culture, villages, towns are built, thriving community. And within that, and security, knowing how to defend itself, and within that, an open window to the future. Because it says, bringing the blessing of progress to all the country's inhabitants. L'chol toshevei ha'aretz. And in subsequent parts of the declaration, l'chol toshevei, to all its inhabitants, referring to those who aren't Jewish, that there's a wide and universal part to the land, to the land itself, although clearly, clearly, clearly Jewish. This is the direction, it's kind of the DNA of the State of Israel, which is, it's very particularistic, but it's very progressive, and it also has that universal element in terms of its full citizenship. I can't be as happy about the Palestinian Charter. It seems to exist in different translations and different renditions. This is from the Palestinian American Consul website, established in 1964. Of course, this is my reading of it. It's not an Arab's reading of it. It's not a Palestinian's reading of it. It wants to establish there's such a thing as a Palestinian people. It asserts it. It asserts it in very strict terms. Article 3, they possess the legal right to its homeland, reparation of its homeland. Palestinian personality in Article 4, that there's such a thing as a Palestinian. Innate persistent character that will not extinct. Wow. And this is inherited by sons from their parents. Negative to the Zionist occupation, dispersal of the Palestinian people as a result of the disasters, here's our term again, Nakba, that befell, do not deprive it from its Palestinian personality. And so Palestine is here to stay. The land belongs to the people belong to the land. There's no sense here, however, of any sort of progress and no sense of accomplishment as a value, certainly no sense of universalism, and no sense of universalism in terms of the land. There's no l'chol toshevei ha'aretz, all the country's inhabitants. Article 6, Jews who were living permanently in Palestine until the beginning of the Zionist invasion, i.e. 1917, will be considered Palestinians, a small and clearly separate group. What can we do? I read this. And you say to me, or I say to myself, can anything be done? Because, in fact, what I read from A and B, from the Declaration of the Establishment of the State of Israel, if anything, it gets more effusive and more progressive, while the Palestinian Charter, if anything, as it continues, seems to continue its narrowing. But I am undeterred because the Palestinian state, if it will be, is something that we will need to understand. Not only our role in it, meaning our role in relationship to it, I still plan to be in the land of Israel. I still plan to be a citizen of the state of Israel, as I'm sure many of you hearing this will yourselves be either now as Israelis or in the future as future Israeli citizens. So I think the best way to tackle this is to recognize the fact that we ourselves have always had challenges theologically. And one of the great challenges of modernity was how do we reconsider the fact that we ourselves need a state and we ourselves need a theology of the state. And to understand the great challenge, I'd like you to look with me and see the Babylonian Talmud from Tractate Ketuvot. And here you're looking at a document edited around 499 CE from earlier material, and it speaks about the objections of having an autonomous Jewish country in the land of Israel. Based upon a hermeneutic of the Song of Songs, and a repetition of the Song of Songs, in which the Shulamite, who stands for the Jewish people, Hishbatiachem benot Yushalayim, she causes the daughters of Jerusalem to swear, or the word of translation we have here, I adjure you. And this term Hishbatiachem happens three times. There's three adjurations. Another way of saying that is oath, three different oaths. And what are they? Look in the middle and underline. One, that Israel should not go up altogether as surrounded by a wall. We're really talking here about like a Roman phalanx and how people gird themselves together, put their shields together, and go forward. If you're going to come to Israel and you're going to go up to Israel, you should not make Aliyah as a phalanx, as an attacking group. This is giving up the whole notion of reconquering. The second adjuration or oath that Israel must take, that whereby the Holy One, blessed be He, adjured Israel, they should not rebel against the nations of the world. You got to get along, and you can't go up without their permission. You can't rebel against them. Forgiving the conditions of galut, of exile. One notion of galut, of exile, is you can't create a militia and an army there and come here to the land of Israel and conquer in a phalanx. And the second is you can't do this without the legitimacy of the nations. And the third adjuration is that the Holy One, blessed be He, adjured the idolaters. Sorry for that term, but it means the non-Jews. These are terms that are used interchangeably, and they're not as they're not meant to cause offense as much as you might think. So let's say adjure, because the terms are not clear what the original term was. Adjure the non-Jews, the Gentiles, that they shall not oppress Israel too much. They shouldn't oppress Israel too much. Israel will be in the galut. There will be oppression, but can't be too much. And these are the great three adjurations or oaths. Here, we can note that these Shavuot, these adjurations, don't strike me, as being whimsical or silly. They bespeak the fact that Israel has to know, this will offend many Jews, its place. It has to know that military adventures don't make sense. It means to say, and it tells us, that you can't go it completely alone. And there needs to be restraint in any moral way, in any political way, restraint on those who kind of control our future as we're in the diaspora. Those are three adjurations. Then there are three more that are mentioned in the Talmud as kind of subsidiary to that. You can see it a little bit further down. The three include that the prophet shall not make known the end, that the people shall not delay the end, and they shall not reveal the secret to the idolaters, to the non-Jews, meaning the whole notion of aspiration of when indeed the end of the exile will take place is something that should be on the QT. It should be quiet, should not become the main conversation. But at the same time as the main conversation, nothing should stop a direction, a positive direction, towards that end of the exile. And certainly this conversation mostly should be an internal conversation. All this is risky business. At the end, or towards the end, it says, the Holy and Blessed Be said to Israel, if you'll keep the adjuration well and good, but if not, I will permit your flesh, meaning I will open you up to make you vulnerable, to be a prey, like that of the gazelles and the hinds of the field, just as the term, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles and by the hinds of the field. You'll be like them, you'll be prey. So this whole notion of the end of the galut is not a simple notion. And that indeed there is some sort of balance within the galut. We don't go up with a phalanx, we don't go on attack, no military ventures. We don't rebel against the nations of the world. And finally, we make sure, not make sure, but we make sure that it's brought up to the non-Jews, they should not oppress Israel too much. If all this is the case, where is the warrant for Zionism? And this became quite a conversation, religious conversation, theological conversation, amongst the greatest scholars of Talmud. There were, of course, many who said they're all in place and we have to stay where we are. That's post-Holocaust times became known really as the position of the Satmar Rav, the Hasidic Rebbe from the Satmar district, the St. Mary district in Hungary. Yoel Teitelbaum, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, Yoelish Teitelbaum, Rav Yoelish, and said, okay, this is the way it's supposed to be. He doesn't even say these are mitzvot per se. He said these are beliefs. And it's heretical to assume anything else. Zionism is a great heresy. Zionism is going against this condition of the Jewish people. We have to wait till God changes the situation. Powerfully religious people, both from the what became known as religious Zionist camp and even what was known as the Agudas Yisrael or Haredi, what became the Haredi camp, said it could very well be that these three oaths have been given the ghost. Take the third one. The third one is that the nations of the world are supposed not to oppress the Jewish people too much. Well, we've had enough of that. We've had complete and utter oppression in every country, every land, in every possible way, culminating event being the Holocaust. And therefore, according to many authorities, many thinkers, this is it, because the oaths are based on a tit-for-tat. We decide not to go up as a phalanx. We make a decision to obey the and get along and not to rebel against the nations of the world. But that's because if we are allowed to exist, not even exist in the best way, but are allowed to exist, once they gave up on that oath, our oaths are rendered null and void. Others look at it in the following way. We're not supposed to rebel against the nations of the world. But it's clear from the Balfour Declaration in 1917 and from the San Remo Conference, the Remo Conference, that took place in 1920 in Italy, International Conference, and certainly the United Nations Declaration, that Zionism is not only permissible but fine, and not only fine, but the Jews can have a nation of their own. And therefore, there's a legitimacy that comes to the Jewish people for their nation out of the fact that the land itself, nationhood itself, is guaranteed by an international conference. As regarding the first notion of not going up like a phalanx, it could just be said we only made a phalanx in self-defense. And therefore, while the Satmar Rav says no, 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 and very interestingly he says, when he says not rebel against the nations, doesn't mean Western or Eastern European nations. It means don't rebel, or nations in Africa or Asia, don't rebel against the nations within the Middle East. You have to make sure that they're in agreement. Zionists, religious Zionists, and Agudas Yisrael, quasi-Zionist, says if we wait for that, we're going to be waiting too long of a time. The fact that they have attacked us, the fact that they have not agreed with us, renders all these oaths gone. An interesting question is, so where are we in terms of our own nationhood? Well, we've lived with an interesting balance, even though the balance at times is out of whack. We've lived with the balance that we're here because of our own desire to be here. We're here because of our love for this land. We're here because we're thrown out of so many other places. We're here because of the earlier promise. We're here because, as Rabbi Elazar said, called Dor Be'eretz Yisrael Sharui B'lo Avon. Whoever domiciles in the land of Israel, lives in Israel, lives without sin, as it were, means he starts afresh and starts anew. All that takes place. So we have that. On the other hand, there is a recognition that that legitimacy granted by the nations of the world is a core part of how we are supposed to live. Not even taking the Satmar Rav's view that it has to be the legitimacy of the nations around us, but the United Nations decision is a major decision. And the fact that we continue to have that legitimacy, while it is spurned by some, strikes me as part and parcel of the Talmudic piece, the Babylonian Talmudic piece of Tractate Ketuvot, that you actually really need it, and probably you continue to need it. Another way of saying this is that we whipsaw from the fact that perhaps we achieve legitimacy. On the other hand, why should we care about what they say? They, the nations of the world, have violated their oath not to subjugate us too badly, and we whipsaw between the two. But actually, this notion of doing things on our own, doing things for ourselves, evidently, according to this Gemara Ketuvot, still needs to be balanced with universal legitimacy. I know those are fighting words to some. The Shulchan Aruch tells us, and this is based on an earlier piece of the Talmud, that no matter what, Jews have a place in the land of Israel. If the husband says they must go up to the land of Israel, and she, the wife, does not want to, she's divorced and she doesn't get her ketubah, and vice versa. Wow, in this document. If she wants to make aliyah and he does not want to, she divorces him and she gathers her ketubah. Well, she's divorced through the court, and she gathers her ketubah, her wedding contract. And for that matter, it's the same as for the whole land of Israel going up to Jerusalem. Section 5 on page 3, there's an opinion that coercion to go up to the land of Israel, I mean coercing one spouse, coercing the other, is only when it's possible to do so without danger. You can't subject a person to inordinate danger. And that brings up the fact, well, maybe on that basis, no one needs to go in Aliyah. This is one opinion. This opinion that will never be, you have to do it only when there's no danger, is one of the greatest fantasies and myths possible. So what we have here at the end is the notion of the Jews formulated an approach to going. It's an individual approach, husband and wife. It's a communal approach in terms of ketuvot, what we saw there. There are times in which we cannot no longer trust the nations of the world. On the other hand, there's a time in which the nations of the world also grant us a certain legitimacy, which is very important, and we can come back and we can change our existence. This is the response to creating the theology, or one of the building blocks, there's obviously more to it, of what it is to have a Jewish people. It comes the time that we need to take care of our own, and we try, and maybe this is the best way of saying it, try and attempt and want to do it, and should want to do it, within the context of a world legitimacy. That is one of the reasons, it's not just practical, why UN resolutions that are against us, or Zionism is racism, or being boycotted by other nations is not a simple matter for us. It does affect us. It affects us practically, but also affects us in some ideological basis. I know people don't want to hear that. We want to do all of it based on our own, but the three oaths have something to it. The three oaths are saying, you know, you still got to live within a world. And at least you got to try to do your best to assure that you have legitimacy. And you can't easily discount that. You can't just say we do everything on our own. It's just also not true. We don't do everything on our own. We need allies. We need help. We need support. We need places to go, people to help us as we offer our own help. So now the question is, how can we look at this, at the rise of another nation in our midst? And so to do so, I'd like to go with you to F, the Lights of Israel, and to go to actually the greatest theological thinker, pre-state thinker, thinker about the Jewish people, who are the Jewish people, and what will it mean when they have a land of their own, a state of their own. Abraham Isaac Akoin Cook, someone who was extraordinarily attuned to biblical, prophetic, Talmudic, and mystical, and contemporary, and for his time, contemporary Zionist and literary Zionism approach to be a person who has autonomy in their land. And therefore, what does it have to do with an Arab state? Well, we have to understand our state that much better. Let's look at the Lights of Israel, F, which I've translated some pieces of it, Orot Yisrael, and he has something very amazing to say in the very first context. Knesset Yisrael, the people of Israel, he, Tamsita Havayakula, is the microcosm of all existence. Now, Knesset Yisrael is a mystically laden term. Knesset Yisrael, the people of Israel, the commune of Israel, the grouping of Israel, we'll say here the people of Israel, is a mystical term that is the same term used for the 10th Sfirah, the 10th manifestation of God's presence, which is sometimes called Shekhinah, and just use the Hebrew terms, or presence, Malchut, kingship, or Knesset Yisrael, this is the people of Israel. It's not by accident. Somehow the presence of God for the Jews is found in many ways within the people of Israel. It's the microcosm of all existence. Let me read my translation. This refers in a worldly context to Israel's material and spiritual dimensions, both its saga, its narrative, and its faith. Israel's history is ideal microcosm of universal history. There is no social fluctuation among the people of the world that you will not find its prototype in Israel. Its faith is the well-sifted essence as well as the influential source of the good and the ideal of all faiths. In this sense, Israel's faith serves as a resource that reviews belief systems, could even say criticizes belief systems, with the goal of elevating their discourse so that all may call on the name of the Lord your God. And here's this evangelical moment in Isaiah. Velkecha Kadosh Yisrael, your God, the Lord your God, the separate one of Israel. Kadosh literally is sanctified, but also even more literally, separate one of Israel. Elohe Kol Ha'aretz Yikorei. He will be called the God of the entire earth. I mean, the real problem is to move from particularism to universalism. But Rav Kook's move from particularism to universalism is not that of the assimilationists or the easy universalists. It's actually a very hard route, a very glorious route. It's like that in art, is that the more particular the picture, the more universal potentially is its relevance. And for Rav Kook, what Jews have gone down through their history is not something apart from all other nations, kind of a Martian idea that the nations of the world are one thing and the Jews are something else, and perhaps even higher. Nor is it the fact that the Jews are just one more nation, Kachol HaGoyim, just like everybody else, but it's something different. It's more like what Mark Twain said about the Jews. The Jews, he said, he wrote, are like everyone else, except more so. And this, for Rav Kook, becomes his goal and his mission for the Jewish people. They should be like everyone else, but more so. Meaning that their experience is in its particularity is a universal experience. Let me tell you how I interpret this. I interpret this as that the great events in the Jewish for the Jewish people has its universal significance. You can't get more particular than being a Jew in Egypt and being a slave. But that slave experience became manifest as a validated experience, as being real in so many of the oppressed nations of the world, and we can also include in that the American blacks. And the Exodus, which shows such great hope, how things can change, and that story within the Seder is something that is emulated by so many people. The Seder is celebrated even by the President of the United States, who sees and seems to see within that story a universal liberation that began within a particular liberation. I would continue with that, with the acceptance of Torah at Sinai, the fact that there is law, and law is more important than the individual wish, and that there is a moral law. We continue with these particular experiences, which are completely and absolutely Jewish, but have a universal impact. The notion of Churban, of destruction, that we celebrate, or commemorate, I should say, on Tisha B'Av is something which is understood by a nation, that by a world, that can link both Churban and Holocaust to the notion of a global Holocaust that could reach everyone, that the worst can happen if we're not careful, if we don't do our duties. The notion of not only Churban, but Galut, of exile. Well, diaspora studies now refer to a whole wide range of people. We haven't given anything up to Jews. The Jews went through a very hard diaspora. But when the Dalai Lama wants to know, how did you survive in your diaspora? He knows it's to the Jews one needs to ask that question. Because that's something which we didn't want to have, but once we had it, we made it into something. And of course, the Geula, the redemption that comes with the Zionist movement. And here we have the difficulty that the Zionist movement of wanting your own place and wanting your own land and creating your own structures into a medina, into a state, is something which is so attractive that we actually created within our own midst a people who emulate us. I'm speaking a Jewish narrative of the Palestinian state, not a Palestinian narrative of the Palestinian state, I can't, but a Jewish narrative, a potential narrative, a potentially hopeful narrative, that actually they're emulating us. This whole notion of how minorities can live together, how different groups can live together, not just minorities, but different groups can live together. This is one of the greatest tasks of all time. I think Israel in many, many, many ways have had terrific traction for success. The openness of our hospitals, the openness of our scientific endeavors, the relative openness of our marketplace, it could be more open, but the relative marketplace of our business activities, the fact of the the great freedom that people have within the state to create and to move, it's not simple, but it's there. This is a traction which you can build, in which the Zionist endeavor, in which you create a state which is good for Ochol Toshaveha, it's good there for all of its inhabitants. It can be an aspect of what Jews bring to the world on the same level of how do you survive slavery, how do you persist towards an exodus? How do you maintain and accept and proclaim a moral law? How do you go through destruction? How do you go through exile, including a almost cosmic exile? And how does one achieve, therefore, Geula? How does one achieve redemption? On page 4 out of the 5 pages, when he continues to discuss this fact that the Jewish people's saga is a microcosm of all the sagas, and that it depicts a God that appeared to the Jews, as it would say, in a very specific direction to the Jews, but it will become the God of all nations. He says in number 2, towards the 2/3 down, Knesset Yisrael, this community of Israel, the people of Israel, is the revelation of the arm of the Lord within the world. It means participation of God within the world. His hand in existence. His participation. Get this. I did not read this. It was written by Rav Kook. His participation within the development of nations. B'vinyan ha'lumim. The building of nations is described by Rav Kook as a divine activity. a nation, of course, what type of nation we're talking about, a nation that has laws, a nation that takes care of its people, a nation that doesn't set out to have war. Of course, we have terrific amount of desire that this work out, and we all know that it can only work out if it works out properly. But you can't have the peace without security, and you can't have security without the peace, and you can't have it without the validation of valid attempts to achieve people's own life. There's much more to say, but let me just leave with this one piece from Rav Kook, in number 4 on page 4. The essential desire of being tov, being good to all, and that's how he actually defines God, or evokes God. We don't define God. God is infinite. But the salient quality of God is being tov, good to all without any sort of limitation. This desire to be tov is something akin to divinity. That's what he says in the second paragraph. Knesset Yisrael, in the depth of desire, is not at all separated from divinity. Desire, as it exists, is itself the divine desire of God being tov to all. The way that the Jewish people can begin to conceive of this emergence of a separate people would be from our own midst, as it were, would be, and with all the protection we need, with all security we need, I don't give up on any one of those type of details, is the notion of Tov Hashem Lakol, God is good to all. It's the notion of generosity, the notion of responsibility of the nation that's being created, the notion of being of them of themselves creating security and secure situation. Tov must vanish all. It's the secret of Gulah. He says, your Tov must vanish all. This is where we're looking. We're looking towards a Yom Ha'atzmaut, which is freedom for ourselves, the most incredible freedom that took place. We had even all these oaths set against us. The most we could hope for is that they would not oppress us too much, the nations of the world. And through this development of finding our own Yom Ha'atzmaut, our liberation, we can call others to the same form as we have there in the Declaration of Independence, of independence, which is an independence of giving, of creating, of being productive, of being, in the end, good to all. I wish you the most happy, successful, imaginative, and prophetic Yom Ha'atzmaut.
Thank you, Rabbi Landes. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.